Tonight on Arena, great news for the Irish in today's BAFTA nominations and Marina Carr and Roger Doyle on their new opera, iGirl. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The BAFTA nominations were announced this morning and there was great news for Irish artists in those particular nominations. Andrew Scott, Aisling Bea and Derry Girls all nominated, as was Irish actor Helen Behan, nominated in the category of Best Supporting Actress for her role in the Channel 4 drama series The Virtues. And Helen joins me on the line right now. Congratulations, first of all, Helen. How do you hear these things? Does it just fizzle through to you?
Thank you, Sean. I'm disbelief, utter disbelief, to be honest with you. I obviously knew that they were being announced today some weeks ago, but because I thought this was a round that didn't, you know, involve me in particular, I just kind of forgot about it, and so was fast asleep this morning and woke up to a barrage of congratulations, and I had no idea what was going on until I opened my messages, and that's how I heard. I had a few missed calls from my agent and a missed call from our director and producer and co-stars, and it's been an unbelievable day.
Yeah, and all of whom must have been pretty excited as well, particularly your co-stars and those who worked on The Virtues with you. Stephen Graham, who played your brother in that, there's a story behind that that people who saw the series will understand. He was nominated in the Best Actor category. Shane Meadows was nominated in Best Director. And also the writer of the piece, Jack Thorne, was nominated for his work. So there must have been great delight, particularly among the Virtues cast and crew.
Five nominations in total we've had for The Virtues. Mm. And also Elizabeth is Missing, which is a project I've been involved in as well, as you know, has been nominated for Best Miniseries, and with Glenda being nominated for Best Actress. So it's been really a phenomenal day. I've just actually had a call with Shane, our director, Mark, our producer, Nikki, our producer, and Stephen, and Niamh Algar, who was in it too. We all just had a chat together and a little toast. So everybody's absolutely over the moon.
Yeah, because The Virtues itself is nominated in the Best Miniseries category. So is it up against your other project with Glenda Jackson? And I notice now you're calling her Glenda, your great pal Glenda, is she?
My good pal Glenda Jackson, my mother, my other grandmother, as I refer to her. Do you know what? I haven't actually, in all the madness of today, sat down to look at exactly what's and what. We might be up against them series-wise, but I'd have to clarify. But for me, it's a phenomenal day. I mean, I never imagined that I'd be at this point with it. So it's to be involved in something that's been so memorable and so so well received.
Yeah.
To get this nod is everybody's just saying, you know, Shane is delighted, Stephen's delighted, and of course Stephen's been nominated over the years. But this, I think he has a win coming for this. I'd be very hopeful for him Shane.
You mentioned, I think it was two missed calls from your agent. I'd say any calls from an agent in the current climate must be, they're always welcome calls, but particularly welcome at the moment. How bad has it been? How quiet has it been, Helen?
It's been shockingly quiet. It's been shockingly quiet. And I suppose, luckily for me, I've had my nursing to fall back on, and no greater time have I been needed than in the last few weeks. So it's been great to be useful and to be at work. And let it be known, as soon as Hollywood comes knocking, I'll be running in that direction. But I just got cast in a project, actually, 3 days before lockdown occurred, and it promptly shut down afterwards. So I think everybody's in the same boat, although there was a lot of discussion tonight about production going back into operation this August in the UK. How real or possible that is remains to be seen. But I think everybody's in the same boat. There's been a lot of brilliant work, a lot of projects going on in Irish theatre online, which has been great to see. So I think everybody's eager to get back to it, but when that's a possibility, it remains to be seen.
You can rest easy, by the way, that you aren't up against yourself, because, of course, Elizabeth is Missing is a single drama, and it's been nominated in that category, whereas
there
The Virtues...
you know more than me.
The Virtues is a mini-series, so it's in a different category. So, so you can cheer for both.
Happy days, happy days. I'll be waving the flag for both, correct and right.
Had you any idea the Virtues was such a... we spoke about it at the time and I found it very affecting, I must say, and a lot of people did. Had you any idea that it was going to... that it would have the kind of impact that it did have, and now these BAFTA nominations must really, you know, put the nail on that for you, or amplify that for you?
Yeah, I mean, I knew doing it that it was something spectacular and something unusual and something that just wasn't being done a whole lot. The length of time that was spent, you know, exploring each character and their feelings and their depth, you know, I knew that it was something very, very special. And I would have imagined that you know, Shane would be recognised and Stephen for their work. But for me, essentially, as much work as I had done, it was my first kind of big body of work, so I never envisaged, hand on heart, never envisaged that it would be an option for me. And Shane kind of mentioned back at the time, oh, you know, we'll be seeing you at the BAFTA, and I just put my hand up. I said, don't be saying things like that, because I wouldn't like to get my hopes up. And so I didn't. I just kind of cast it aside. Yeah. I knew the project was very special, very important to Shane, and therefore very important to us. But never did I think I'd be here today, on the receiving end of this.
Of course, it'll be a virtual TV BAFTA ceremony, but nevertheless, it's still a real BAFTA nomination. One other thing, did you say there, Helen? Because I know you have worked as a nurse previously, and you've had the two things running alongside each other at certain times as well.
Yes.
Have you had to dip back into nursing, or did you want to dip back into nursing during this particular time?
I have dipped back in because I wanted to. I wanted to work, you know, and I wanted to use my skill. And there's colleagues doing greater than me, you know, in ICU in particular. I've been working in a COVID assessment hub, and I've been very happy to lend my skill to that. And thankfully, because of everybody's great work, you know, we're getting a handle on it. And it was a scary thing to dive into initially, but I feel quite safe there, and great to be able to kind of put my skills to use while health was shut down. So, there was no other option in this crisis for me. There's something in all nurses, I believe, and all medics, you know, a compulsion to help out when you come across something that's as devastating as this has been for society and community. So to be able to do anything was my pleasure and my privilege. Yeah.
Well, indeed, it says something about you for sure, Helen, that despite BAFTA nominations and the successes that you have been having, that is still the way that you're thinking. Congratulations again. Lovely to speak with you.
Thanks so much, Sean.
I'll be speaking to you after July as a BAFTA winner, but the nomination...
Absolutely. Hopefully I'll be carrying some heavy bit of material for the mantelpiece.
All right. Thanks a million. That's Helen Behan there, nominated for a BAFTA for her role in the miniseries The Virtues. Andrew Scott, Aisling B and Derry Girls all nominated as well. So what a lot of joy that might give us come the end of July. Well, it is Thursday, and that is, whether there's a pandemic or not, it's still movie night. We have had the pick of this week's new digital releases with new work from Woody Allen and Canadian filmmaker Sophia Bodanovich. But first, the new Irish film Dating Amber, which is released on Amazon Prime this week. It stars Fiona O'Shea, who played the horrible Jamie in Normal People recently, and Lola Pettigrew. The film is made by David Frayne and tells the story of two teens who pretend to be in a relationship. And Daryl Jones and Tara Brady are our reviewers this evening. You're saying from the outside, Daryl, that this particular film is a film that has loads of heart.
Oh, I think it does. There's very much to like about this film. So its heart is in the right place. Its politics are very sound, and I think its leads are both very good. You know, its evocation of well, rural Kildare in the 90s is very well done. And you know, it's a high school movie, and like all high school movies, it's actually a movie about high school outsiders, which means that it's often excruciatingly well observed. The cast of appallingly insensitive, you know, dorks and ghouls that we were all forced to spend our teenage school days with is very well done here.
And Fiona O'Shea and Lola Pettigrew playing these two leading roles, Tara. And I'm giving nothing away to say that they are both gay, because that's there from the very beginning. It's set down. So there's a line that has to be balanced here by David Frayn between it's a serious issue, obviously, for the two young teenagers. There's also lots of, I suppose, the comedy that you might want to get in a teen drama is in there as well. How does he balance those two aspects?
Well, sometimes he does and sometimes he doesn't. I think the film is always at its best when it's really heartfelt, when it's this lovely little coming of age story. And ironically, for a film that's about pretending to be something you're not, where it kind of goes a bit screwy is when the film pretends to be something it's not. I mean, there's a faux sex education video featuring a nun that I don't think should have made the final cut at all of this or any other film, because it sort of not only is a comic misfire, it undermines the film around it. And I think the film is kind of trying too hard to be too many things at once. It sort of wants to have a toe in reality, but it also wants to be kind of a slick, you know, like one of the new kind of corporate gay studio films like Love, Simon. And there are moments in the depiction of school life where it's going for something like The In-Betweeners or Sex Education. And there's this level of snark even in the TV announcements that you hear in the background, and or the kind of fake melodrama that they go to watch in the cinema that doesn't quite sit right with the really big-hearted indie dramedy that this should be.
In fact, you're talking about the faux sex scenes there. It did strike me that perhaps if they had got the real sex education videos from the 1990s, they wouldn't have needed any faux scenes at all.
I thought exactly that. But you know, when it's at its best, it's like in the little small moments. I just love the unresolved domestic drama between Barry Ward and Sharon Horgan, who are playing the main character's parents, and you know, the younger brother who thinks he gets everything, but he doesn't really get everything. And I just wish it kind of had stayed with that film instead of straying off into this kind of broad sort of crass comedy bits that just doesn't, they don't quite integrate as a whole, even though the film itself is a very likable thing.
Yeah, let's listen to a scene which actually features the family, as you mentioned. It's Sharon Horgan who plays the mother here, and Barry Ward plays the father. And at this point, Fiona O'Shea, as Eddie, has brought his so-called girlfriend, Amber, played by Lola Pettigrew, over to visit the family. And Mum and Dad are very interested in finding out what kind of future she might have.
Amber, Eddie was saying that you help your mum out in the caravan park.
I hate it.
Right, it's nice for her.
Do you, or have you decided what you'll do next year?
Probably study English or history or politics or maybe work for a zine.
It's a self-published magazine.
Is there much money in the zine scene?
Tons.
Oh, that's interesting. Eddie, you might want to think about that as a choice.
Joining the army?
Yeah, it's just one option, isn't it?
It's a very solid option.
Yeah, well, the army takes a lot of sacrifice, that's all.
Yeah, so does marriage.
Pardon?
So does marriage, because a lot of sacrifice.
What sacrifices have you made?
I mean, do you want it in writing?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Like a list?
Yes, a list.
How long have we got?
A very tiny list.
Get your A4 pen.
I think that Eddie would look really manly and hot in uniform. I mean, morally, I don't agree with national armies, but still. Super sexy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, babe. We're going to go to my room.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, do you want some trifle? Do you want trifle? I can bring it up in two cups. Leave your door open.
There we go. Sharon Horgan is the final voice you heard there in that scene from Dating Amber. Sharon Horgan, Barry Ward as the mother and father. Fiona O'Shea and Lola Pettigrew as the couple that are making lots of protestations about just how heterosexual they are. Tara was saying there about, sometimes the comedy misfires. There are also times when it really fires well. I remember there was a couple of things stood out for me. The anarchist bookshop that Amber wants to open, and she says she wants it to be an anarchist bookshop with franchise potential. There are some really That's funny right. sections in this film.
There are, and like I actually found the sex education video scene very, very funny, and the scene where Eddie and Amber go on their first date in the cinema, and you begin to realise that they're the only ones actually watching the film, made me laugh a lot all the way through, and there's a terrific and kind of touching scene in which Eddie and his macho dad takes him for a sort of manly rural bonding session out in the country, and they go fishing, and his dad says to him, remember, fish are nature's pot noodle. It's full of sweet and funny moments. In the end, not quite sharp or funny enough for me, but nevertheless, I'll go back to what I said at the beginning. There is much to like about this film because its heart is absolutely in the right place.
And I think, despite some of your reservations, Tara, particularly maybe in and around the 1990s setting where the divorce referendum is brought in, and maybe they're biting off too much, I think you have that same sense of the heart of the film being in the right place.
Oh, definitely. No, it's a very sweet film, and Fiona O'Shea and Lola Pettigrew are absolute stars. That's the part I think that really worked best for me is their awkwardness under their own skin. And when the comedy is derived from that awkwardness, golly, it's a great film.
Yeah, and when Fiona O'Shea is cycling in through the firing range of the Curragh with the Walkman, as it would have been, on his ears, that also got a bit of a laugh for me. So you both enjoyed the heart of the film, maybe not as sharp as you wanted. Overall, starts from you, Daryl.
I want to be generous to this, so I'm going to say four.
Four from you. And what are you saying, Tara?
I'll go three.
You're going three on that. That's Dating Amber, film, Irish film, which will be available on Amazon Prime. A Rainy Day in New York, a film which was completed 3 years ago and which has been mired in controversy after Amazon Studios and indeed the film's lead actor washed their hands of it, as it were. Before we get to the controversy, let's find out if it's a good film. We're talking about Woody Allen. That's what all the controversy is about. But what's the basic premise here, Tara?
Well, you ask a good question. There's an awful lot of meandering around this film. We're used to having someone playing the Woody Allen character, and the Woody Allen character here is played by Timothy Chalamet, and he's a rather privileged young man who goes to an upstate New York private school, and he goes to spend a day in New York with his girlfriend, played by Elle Fanning, who's this sweet Midwestern girl. She is going off to interview a sort of pained artist filmmaker played by Liev Schreiber, and they organise to spend the day together, but he wants to avoid his socialised parents while he's there, and that's pretty much the premise. After that, it's just kind of running around and bumping into things. Elle Fanning is basically the equivalent of an old 70s movie getting chased around the desk by three older gentlemen across the course of the day. Meanwhile, Timothy goes off and has adventures of his own, most notably with Selena Gomez, who's the younger sister of an old pal.
Yeah.
Mostly, it's just an excuse to put together sort of Woody Allen witticisms. The main problem here, and this is an issue that we saw before with anything else, is that those witticisms don't really sit well with young naturalistic actors, and everything about Timothy Chalamet's acting style and Elle Fanning's acting style rubs up against that sort of classic Upper East Side milieu that Woody Allen has fashioned over the years, and you have like sort of young 20 something 20-something characters, and their cultural allusions are things like, you know, she's fine if you like Grace Kelly. And you're like, no, I don't know any 20-year-olds who speak like this. I'm not even sure 20-year-olds spoke like that when Woody Allen started making films 20? 4 decades ago.
All right. Well, I suppose the thing here is, Daryl, though, the film starts out, you hear the tinkly jazz piano background. You hear a voiceover, which, if you haven't seen the character yet, that sounds terribly like Woody Allen. If he were about 20 years old, it would sound like him. And the character is called Gatsby. You know what you're going to get.
He's called Gatsby Wells, Wells with an E as in Orson Welles. And I thought, oh my God, you know, you do know what you're gonna get. Woody Allen is a fundamentally autobiographical filmmaker. More than that, I think his films are his life. He just keeps making them. So it's impossible to separate the man from his work. And, you know, in large part, I think what he's doing here is remaking Manhattan. Manhattan is a film in which, you know, a middle-aged man, Woody Allen was then 44, has a relationship with a much younger 17-year-old girl, Mariel Hemingway. Now, you know, obviously he can't make that film anymore, nor should he. Yeah. But he's making it by proxy, by casting Chalamet as a proxy version of himself. And I think Tara's absolutely right. It's very clearly, you know, no 20-year-old likes what Gatsby Wells likes. Doesn't like old, no 20-year-old talks about old movies, about Charlie Parker, about piano ballads, but I'll tell you who does. You know, Woody Allen does.
All
that's
right.
Who. So your 20-year-old lead is actually an 85-year-old man in disguise.
Well,
and you're in trouble then.
Let's listen to a scene featuring the aforementioned Timothy Chalamet. And at this point, he's talking to Selena Gomez, who, as Tara told us, is the sister, rather, of an old girlfriend.
These are like movie big shots he's hanging out with, like...
Suits?
He has a director and a screenwriter.
Artists. They're usually passionate.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Okay, you're right. I gotta call her now.
I mean, the sooner the better.
You think there's that much of a rush?
I don't know.
Oh, Christ. All right. All right, it's your idea. So what do you think I should say?
There's nothing you can say.
What do you mean?
Without sounding possessive, it's...
Christ, Jan, you just encouraged me to call her. Now I'm asking for your help, and you're telling me there's nothing I can say?
You're so wishy-washy. I mean, now that I see your MO, I know exactly why Amy 86'd you.
Oh, no, no, no. Amy didn't dump me. I got sick of seeing her.
Yeah, because every time you'd call and I'd say it was you on the phone, she'd wave her arms and say, I'm not in.
Timothy Chalamet there and Selena Gomez in a scene from Woody Allen's A Rainy Day in New York. And so to the controversy here, Tara. Can we watch a Woody Allen film now without getting mired and bogged down in Woody Allen's personal life and the accusations levelled against him by his adopted child?
Well, I as I often say, you know, if we were to boycott every artist, you know, that has ever done anything wrong, we'd live in a world of empty galleries. But I do think this is there are particulars around this case that kind of bother me. And we've seen actors do this before. The current sort of set of handbags between. Well, the current set of handbags between Amazon and Woody Allen is a little bit like weird, because it's not like Amazon didn't know going in that about this. I mean, we're talking about an allegation that dates to 1992. And I have the same feelings about Timothy Chalamet denouncing the film and Selena Gomez also denouncing the film after they've made it. And we've seen actors do this like quite routinely over the last 20 years, like Kate Winslet also did it. It's like, don't make the Woody Allen film and then suddenly decide to take a stance against him. I find that sort of troubling. And there's a pattern of it happening. Then there was sort of it's kind of the tit for tat stuff that kind of was pretty unsightly. You know, Woody Allen then claimed in his recent memoir that it was that Chalamet had done it because his people advised him he needed to disown the film because of the Oscar, and he had gone to Woody Allen's sister and told that. And it was, you know, it's real sort of playground he said, she said stuff. And I find that, I mean, the main problems I have with the film was it's not a very good film, and you sort of wish for all the hoopla around it, it was a little bit better than or a little bit worse. I have seen worse Woody Allen films. Cassandra's Dream was worse and Magic in the Moonlight was worse, but this is pretty much down near the bottom of the pile. Like, structurally it makes no sense. You have people like Cherry Jones pops up as Gatsby's mother towards the end with this big huge revelation, and structurally it makes no sense because we haven't been introduced to that character or met this character once before.
But she is brilliant in that monologue.
She gets this big monologue, though, that has no context. You get these kind of weird one-liners that go nowhere, like time flies, unfortunately it flies coach, that feel like an imitation, a really bad imitation of Woody Allen dialogue. So I don't think the film is, as Amazon suggested, unmarketable, but I don't think it's a very good film. And that's before you get into the sexual politics of the film, which are troubling. I think Elle Fanning's character is the worst female Woody Allen character since Mira Sorvino's Hooker with a Heart of Gold.
Let me talk about Liev Schreiber then, who plays the film director in this, which, you know, you could equally say has a Woody Allen touch to it. The Roland Pollard is the title of the name of the character here, Daryl. He says at one point, the Liev Schreiber character says to the Elle Fanning character, you know, let's go to Paris, or let's go to the south of France for the weekend. You know, so the sexual politics here, Woody Allen must know what he's at when he puts a line like that into a film director's mouth.
He must, and I suspect because he's making the same film over and over again, and because I think he demonstrates that he can't learn from the lessons of his own life, as it were. The film can't help itself. You know, the sexual politics of the film are very troubling and ghastly. In fact, it's a film in which three, or if you count Woody Allen, and I think you must, four older men are all leering and lusting after, you know, 20-year-old, 19-year-old Elle Fanning, you've got Liev Schreiber, who is, yes, he's another proxy for Woody Allen. You've got Jude Law as a screenwriter, yet another proxy for Woody Allen, and you've got Diego Luna as a more kind of conventionally randy leading man, all of whom are sexually focused on Elle Fanning.
So what with this movie then, can we watch it and put all of that to the one side? Did you not get some laughs or some joy out of watching it at all? I'll ask you that first, Darren, and then ask you to finish up with your stars.
Okay, well, yes, it's a Woody Allen film, so it's going to have jokes about death, about sex, about art. They're not very good jokes, but they are good jokes. So of course, I laughed. Not enough, and it's a very problematic, and I think at times a fundamentally a sleazy film. So stars, I docked it a half a star just for the stupid name of Gatsby Wells. So 1.5
from you. What are you saying overall, Tara, and stars?
I'll give it 2 for its pale imitation of what used to be a good Woody Allen film. But I mean, the whole way through, you're looking at the milieu and you're kind of going, you know what? I could be watching Annie Hall right now and enjoying it instead of watching this.
All right. 2 and 1.5 respectively then from Rainy Day in New York from Woody Allen. Let's move on to our final film this evening, M.S. Slavich 7. Third film, a collaboration between the Canadian partnership of director Sofia Bodanovich and the actor Derek Campbell, who also co-directs this movie. What does that title tell us about what we're looking at? Was M.S. standing for manuscript, I'm presuming, Tara?
Yes, that's right. This is it's the library number of an archived series of letters between Bogdanovich's great grandmother, the poet Zasha Bogdanovichova, and the Nobel Prize nominated author Josef Whitlam. So this is really a film about, well, first of all, to say this is a film about research, and it's about being absorbed in research. And the director's proxy for three films now is Derek Campbell. So she's playing some version of the director. And she's gone to pore over these documents where they are kept at Harvard University. So a lot of the film is just her looking at the documents, yeah, and trying to work with a translator on the documents.
Yeah,
and
well, so let me ask
conversations about curation and stuff.
Yeah, let me ask Dara precisely about that. Being absorbed in research is great for the researcher. Watching somebody being absorbed in research mightn't be so good for the viewer, is it?
Oh, crikey, no. I found this an indescribably boring film, and even more so because, you know, this is a world that I know very well. This is what she's doing, the kind of thing that I spend much of my time doing. You know, the film opens with her unpacking her books in a hotel room, and then she heads off to the manuscript library. It's the Houghton Library in Harvard, a place that I've used, and more generally I've been to manuscript rooms, you know, many times. I've spent months at a time poring over literary correspondence, trying to decipher handwriting, having the same kinds of ethical debates that the film has. But the actual business of conducting archival research is often a monotonous and quite a boring one. So that's why I don't want to see films about it.
All right, let me just play a little clip of the Derek Campbell character poring over the manuscript. I'm not going to play all of this. I'm just going to play a little section.
A message that traverses a public system and arrives with a recipient. It travels over distance to get there. And that very action, the very meaning of a letter, like completely aside from the content of the letter.
Now, I just wanted to give an example, a sample there of the delivery of Derek Campbell. I mean, what she's saying, obviously, when you take something out of context, that's a little bit unfair, but it doesn't make for easy listening. What do we need to watch this film in your mind, Tara?
Well, I watched their previous collaboration. I really enjoyed this, but I think you have to get into the rhythm of it. And the rhythm is quite slow. But there are actually like very funny little things. There's the scene with the librarian and the pencil instructions. And there's also the fact that she's so absorbed in her research that, you know, we suddenly realize she is a lover. It's a complete shock. And when things do actually happen that look something like real conflict, like the argument with the aunt over the curation of the letters, it feels like the equivalent of a really bloody nose fight in another film, even though it's just raised voices. So I liked how kind of subtle it was, and the way that it's kind of composed in very small movements. It is very formal. It is very much an experimental film. It's not just art house. It's double art house. So if none of those things sound like they're going to appeal to you, then they really won't appeal to you. But I like how it had lots of questions, and you walk away and you still don't know the relationship of the great grandmother and the poet, and you're still not sure about lots of things, and you're still not sure what skullduggery has gone on about the literary executive position as well.
If you have your double art house hat on, then how many stars does it get?
Yeah, I'd go 3.5.
3.5. What are you saying overall, Daryl?
Oh, dead-eyed, lassitude, passionless, unengaging, monotonous, 1.5.
I think you didn't enjoy that film, is what I'm picking up from you there, Daryl. That's Daryl Jones and Tara Brady speaking to us about M.S. Slavich, which is available on Mubi, by the way. General digital release for the Woody Allen film, and Amazon Prime for Dating Amber, which Tara and Daryl were speaking to us about earlier on. July's Clonmel Junction Festival, like so many others, is going mainly online this year. And one of the events planned for the festival was a concert of the music of Roger Doyle, featuring the world premiere of Oedipus, which is a section from his new electronic opera, I Girl, with a libretto there by Marina Carr. The concert can't now go ahead, but instead there's a film by Trish McAdam featuring a scene from the opera with singer Morgan Crowley, which will be premiered on July the 4th. With me in studio this evening first person I've had in studio for a long time is playwright and the librettist for this opera, Marina Carr. And online and joining us on the phone is composer Roger Doyle, who is also features in a film, The Curious Works of Roger Doyle, which I was looking at earlier on today. Let's start with where this opera started out for you. I think it was a kind of a proposition that Marina put to you, Roger. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. I was at a reception where Alwyn Fowery got an honorary doctorate a couple of years ago, and which a group of us were at. And as I was leaving, Marina said, "Oh, Roger, by the way, what?" She said, "If you're ever thinking of writing another opera, will you give me a call?" Because I had just had one performed in 2016 called Heresy. So a couple of years went by, and I thought I would love to write another opera. I got the opera bug, you could say. And last year in May, there was a closing date for an opera.
Oh, we've lost Roger briefly there. We'll come back to him. But we can pick up with you on this Marina Carr in studio with me, where the line can't fall down, thankfully. I'm presuming you had seen Heresy, or had you seen something of Roger's work that made you think, yeah, well, I want to do an opera with this guy?
Yeah, I'd followed Roger's work for decades and I know him through Alwyn, and I always found it very interesting, very experimental. So to pick up on Roger's story, so we put a proposal together, and Fergus Shield from Irish National Opera and Sina Cartmel from The Gate were backing us, and we all did tremendous work in getting this proposal into the Arts Council, and unfortunately they hadn't the money to fund it. So Roger and myself met to commiserate, and I think, and Roger can correct me when he comes back, but I think it went something like, he said, "Well, do you have anything, you know, lying around?" I said, "Well, actually I do, you know, I have this owl yoke that I wrote that's on the desk, and I'm thinking of starting the fire with it. Maybe I don't know what to do with it." So he said, "Well, send it on to me and I'll have a read of it." So I sent it to him, and he was very taken with it, which was, I was thrilled with, because I hadn't shown it to anyone. I'd just written this thing over 2 days, and he immediately started composing. I think he's been composing for the last year and a half.
What had you written?
A thing. I'm loath to call it a poem, because I think there are too many poets in the country, and also the poets will crucify him. So how dare you? You're just about a playwright. But I don't know, narrative voices, I suppose. So they're extended narrations of certain voices. I called it I, Girl, just to put an overarching title on it. And they're mainly women's voices. And it's interesting you pick out the I, Oedipus section, because that's the only male voice and all the other voices are female. So I have Joan of Arc, I have the narrator, I have Jocasta, I have Antigone, I have Oedipus, and just this narrator. So they're interconnecting kind of things.
And a lot of those characters that you're talking about are obviously big mythical female creatures. That's what you're looking at. That has the essence of opera in it. Yet you weren't thinking of opera when you wrote it down on the page.
No, I was just right. I was between plays and just to keep my hand in, because you get very rusty very quickly if you're not doodling away. So, and any writer will tell you, the waste paper baskets and folders full of things that are just lying around that have never seen the light of day. And I thought this might be one of them. But then talking to Roger, I thought it might actually fit. And I was pleasantly thrilled, actually, by his reaction.
Yeah, well, you say that it's funny that I should single out the Oedipus one. Yes, it is the only male voice, but it's the one that we have the music for, because that's the one that that's the one that has been done for Clonmel. Let's have a listen to some of the music, just to get a sense of the sort of sound that Roger Doyle has given us within this.
Oh,
That's the voice of Morgan Crowley there in the Oedipus section of the opera Aigirl, with a libretto by Marina Carr and music by Roger Doyle. I think we've Roger back on the line at this point. What really struck me, Roger, you're familiar with the music, obviously, but what really struck me when I heard it for the first time today was just the size of what you've created there. It feels like you have a huge orchestra behind Morgan Crowley.
Yes, you've hit the nail on the head. That's exactly one of the things I wanted to do. I wanted to create an epic orchestra. I had bought some new software which allowed you to experiment with orchestral sounds, and I thought, I want to create an epic kind of impossible orchestra in parts of this opera. Mm. So that's exactly what's going on there.
And Marina was telling us when we were getting you back on the telephone line there about the fact that she had this Aigirl, this piece sitting on her desk, and it was perilously close to the waste paper bin before she spoke with you. When you saw what she had written, did you immediately see operatic potential in there?
Oh, yeah. You know, I've worked on and off over the years in theatre with many different scripts, and I've never had such a relationship with a script that I've had with this one. As soon as I saw it, I was more impressed, I think, than with any script I'd read in my life up until then. And that really helped me glide through the composing of it. It was a kind of effortless, magical endeavor, which I began on June the 10th last year. So almost exactly a year later, I've actually completed the whole thing, 2 hours, 20 minutes, in a studio version only, yeah.
And how much of it have you heard, Marina? I know you said to me that you'd heard the Morgan Crowley performance, you'd heard some of that earlier on. Have you heard some of the other sections where the female voices are involved?
I think I've heard it all, Roger, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, except the new 9 minutes that you composed the other night. I haven't heard that yet.
So we really are talking about a work in progress here that's unfolding as we speak. But Roger, I'm interested when you say that it immediately struck you, and that it almost that the music came to you very quickly when you read the script. What was the quality? What was the nature of the script that made it so operatic for you?
The darkness, I think. The darkness, the sadness of it. The otherworldliness of it, I suppose once I started working on it, the way it slotted in to the music, I composed the music first, and then added the text, set the text second, and when I began to set the text, it just fitted in with the music I already had ready for it, you know. To the extent that if there was a speech that lasted, you know, a couple of pages, by the time I got to the very last words of one of the speeches, I was at the last few seconds of the piece of music. You know, all sorts of magic things happened all the way through this.
Yeah, there's a kind of an unusual quality to that, Marina, that magic can happen. But you were laughing as Roger was saying, the darkness, the sadness and the otherworldliness. Words you may have heard once or twice before about your work, I think.
The usual old stuff. But I have to say, listening to what Roger has done with the thing, I mean, the music certainly lifts the text, whatever you want to call it. And I think it's one of these extraordinary things that there's so much now, you know, there are many ways you can collaborate. It doesn't have to be you know, synchronicity, as well, we're all learning that now in this kind of climate or whatever. But the idea that someone can go off separately and write something and then that someone will pick it up a few years down the line and then that it will inspire and that the two things coming together. Because I just love, I love what Roger has done with it. Mm. I love the darkness of the music. I love the hugeness of the sound. I mean, I do think he has created an epic sound. And I think it lifts the what you're attempting at, and yet it's almost it's too big for what we call epic theatre. So it's not. I knew when I was writing it, it couldn't be performed as a play, but I didn't know what it was.
Roger, I was saying in the introduction that I had watched the film, Brian Lally's film, The Curious Works of Roger Dyle, and at one point you say in that film, I never thought I'd write an opera. I nearly fell down when I heard you saying that. I mean, you're the most likely composer I would have thought to compose an opera that I know, given, you know, your whole background in operating theatre with Alwyn Ferrer and that theatrical side to you. Was it just something that had never struck you before, Heresy, which was your first full-length opera?
No, it did strike me, but I actually don't like most opera. It's the vibrato-heavy singing voices that put me off. So that delayed me for many, many years. So once I had the opportunity of working with singers that don't have this vibrato heavy, that sing like pop singers or like early music singers or chansons singers, then I knew I could work with it. Mm-hmm. And once that started happening, when I started working with singers who would offer me like Morgan Crowley that you heard there. You'd give him something to sing, and he'd say, "Okay, how would you like that? Would you like it this way or this way?" He'd offer you alternatives, and for a composer, that's so exciting. But I still hear, in quotation marks, opera, and I think, "Oh no, that's not for me. I'm not an opera person. I'm an outsider." You could say, but a person who doesn't like opera doesn't necessarily make him a bad opera composer, you know.
And what would your attitude have been towards opera in that respect, Marina? Would you have more of openness isn't the right word, that's not what Roger's saying, but would you have a different attitude from Roger to it?
I love opera, and I did a Rigoletto a couple of years back with Fergus, and I did an oratorio for Mary Gordon a couple of years back, the National Concert Hall. I love working with composers. I have to say, this, I think, has probably been my most successful outing with a composer. Just something about, I think, Roger's style. And also I think that the space that was given to each other, I think that helped enormously, that each did their own bit and nobody was editing the other, and there was a tremendous freedom on both sides.
Which sounds ironically that this isolation that we're all currently experiencing was in some ways a positive thing.
Well, this was done way before of this, yeah. But I just down the line, because, you know, there's the temptation and, of course, the fascination and the attraction of theatre and opera and all is that you work very closely with people. But sometimes I think there's a lot to be said for going off and working on your own and just getting the job done and responding in isolation and freedom. I mean, artistic freedom.
Just briefly then, on the current situation, you were saying to me when we were listening at one point there, you've had five different shows that have fallen through. The big show for the Abbey is off for 12 months.
Next September, hopefully.
It was due this autumn, wasn't it?
It was due this autumn. The May was about to go into previews and they had to pull that. To the Lighthouse, an adaptation I did, they were casting that. That's gone. The Portia Coughlin at the Young Vic, the official word on that is it's paused, but I mean, it's not looking great. And then I had a play that was meant to be touring in Italy, but that looks like it's the only thing that's going ahead.
Well, I suppose they're a little bit ahead of us now.
They're allowing 250 people into their theatres and 1,000 people outside. That's the latest I heard from Italy.
Right.
So I'm hoping we'll follow suit fairly soon.
And what about you, Roger? How has the COVID period been for you? Productive or totally unproductive?
No, well, I compose every day, so it hasn't made much difference. You know, I've brought this opera to almost completion. In fact, I thought I had finished it until a few days ago when I did this new 9 minutes.
All right. Well, listen, thanks to both of you for speaking with us this evening. That's Marina Carr and Roger Doyle. And in Clonmel, people will be able to see the Oedipus film by Trish McAdam, featuring the section that we played a little bit of, we played earlier on from the iGirl Opera. That's on July the 4th at the junctionfestival.com. In fact, I'll be speaking to Roger and others in a webinar earlier that day as well as part of that festival. There's also a chance that there will be a projection of the film in Clonmel, and that the larger opera can be accessed then on the Bandcamp page of Roger Doyle. It's called Scenes from iGirl, and you'll find it at rogerdoyle1.bandcamp.com. rogerdoyle1.bandcamp.com. Cork Midsummer Festival is there as well, reimagining its programme, and will be sharing its Midsummer Moments online later this month. We spoke to Cork Adorka last, the theatre company last night, Pat Kiernan, about their travelling theatre show. But composer Tom Lynn joins me now to tell me about two different audio walks that will guide you around Cork City or transport you there from the comfort of your own home if you don't want to go outside. So tell us the idea behind these audio guides. Did they exist previous to this?
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, these were pieces, first one I did originally in 2013, and then the second one was 2015. And the idea is you go to a specific starting point in Cork, and you listen to the piece through headphones, and then it guides you on a route, and there's sounds from the city as well included in that.
One place that I do know in Cork is the Shaky Bridge that you're going to bring people to. You might explain where and what that is, and then I'll play a little bit of the audio guide that we have for it.
So it's known as the Shaky Bridge because it shakes a lot and it moves and it makes really interesting sounds. It's actually called Daly's Bridge. Mm. It's actually closed at the moment for renovations, but we've done a special version which you can experience on any bridge in Cork across the River Lee.
Any bridge you can go to get this shaky sound.
You're going to be transported to the shaky bridge through the sound of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I hope when they fix the shaky bridge that they don't fix the shake. Let's have a listen to the audio guides that you give us if we're on any bridge in Cork, since the Shaky Bridge is currently closed.
Lean closer to one of the pylons of the bridge at the top of the ramp. You can start to hear deeper into the structure of the bridge. Listen. When people walk across it, the bridge acts like an instrument. Even the wind plays the bridge. In a moment, I'll ask you to walk across the bridge. You'll hear the sounds of the material being vibrated and stretched. Now, walk across the bridge to the halfway point.
And that's a little section there from Tom Lane's audio guide to the Shaky Bridge. Well, I was transported, Tom, I have to say. It doesn't matter where you are, in fact, listening to that. You don't even have to be in Cork.
Yeah, well, you know, you could do it any bridge across the world, but there is a part of it which is about the River Lee in particular. So it's great to experience it in Cork if you can get it.
So the Lee is better than any other river in terms of sound, is it, like the city?
Well, yeah, it's a really great river, and it's the subject of the other piece as well.
Yes, because I won't play the second piece, but you bring us into an imagined underwater for the next piece, do you, for the second section?
Yeah, so the piece is called Hidden Currents, and it's about all the different parts of the River Lee which are underground or which have been covered over, because the river as we know it now is two kind of main channels in Cork, and it used to be lots of different ones when the city was more like a marsh. So I recorded sound from lots of different parts of the river, and then the route brings you like around all the kind of underground or the hidden parts of the river. So you're walking on top of the river and kind of listening to it under your feet.
And so did you do much to what you had originally done with these pieces to adapt them for this new reality that we find ourselves in, Tom?
There's a few things like Hidden Currents. It used to begin in the Cork Vision Centre, which is a sort of art space, and it used to finish in the Rivoli Hotel. So obviously these things are closed, so we need to start outside those things. And they did have some things to touch railings and hold onto railings. So we've taken those things out to make it very safe for the current situation.
And incidentally, in the way that these serendipitous things happen, I believe that you're working on something with Marina Carr, who was just in with us here. You're working with a piece with her for the Cork Midsummer Festival. Is that for this year too?
Well, yeah, that was the piece she mentioned, actually, the To the Lighthouse
production, right, the adaptation
directed by Annabelle Cumming. Yeah, so unfortunately, that's one of the many things that it's not taking place this year. Right, it was a really great project.
A casualty, but clearly, as Marina said to us, she enjoys working with composers. What has it been like for you? Are you in accord with Roger Doyle in that respect, Tom, that the compositional life, maybe being alone and in isolation, isn't a bad thing?
In some respects, although it's quite a busy year for me in terms of theatre productions, and I've had six things cancelled this year. So yeah, that's a big chunk of work and it's a big amount of things that you're planning for a long time and put a lot of work into and a lot of preparation and scheduling. Yeah.
Well, I hope that some of them at least will come back into being when this all passes, as surely it will. And that's Tom Lane speaking to us there. The audio walks will be available to listen to from the 10th through until the 21st of June as part of Cork Midsummer Festival. And it's called Midsummer Moments. You can find out full details on the website corkmidsummer.com. That's our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Andrew Kane was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.